A new Trump administration official is in charge of assessing climate research. And he's a doozy.
A clip from 2014 of him popped up comparing the regulation of carbon dioxide to the Holocaust.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. How discrediting climate science fits into a decades-long mission to make the rich richer.
You have to give conservatives some credit here. They played a long game, and they funded an intellectual movement. The Democrats were much more short-term in their thinking.
And taking the long view, really long, on what we've done to the planet and what to call this age of destruction.
The amount of plastic is something of the order of 4 to 5 billion tons, which is enough to wrap the whole Earth in a layer of plastic wrap.
It's all coming up after this.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Black Friday last year, the federal government released its National Climate Assessment, a document that spelled out in black and white that climate change is a far, far more catastrophic problem than had previously been reported.
The report says extreme weather and climate-related events could worsen in the future and significantly impact our economy.
The report was hidden, intentionally, behind the inevitable chaos of the holiday weekend. Less than a month ago, the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services released its shocking finding that as many as 1 million plant and animal species are now at risk of extinction. That report was obscured amidst a whirlwind of Mueller media hand-wringing. And over the weekend, the public was made aware of yet another instance of political malfeasance vis-a-vis climate catastrophe.
The administration is also targeting the National Climate Assessment, which is produced every 4 years. Scientists are already working to put out the next report, and they've reportedly been ordered to not automatically include worst-case scenario projections.
The EPA said this about the change. Quote, the previous use of inaccurate modeling that focuses on worst-case emission scenarios that does not reflect real-world conditions needs to be thoroughly re-examined and tested.
Now, Trump is reportedly considering that guide to run his own climate change review panel, designed specifically to undermine actual assertion of actual climate change scientists in the government. What could possibly go wrong?
Meanwhile, the most important story in human history struggles to penetrate the daily cacophony of scandal, gossip, political conflict, and presidential perfidy. Kate Aronoff is a fellow at the Type Media Center. She wrote recently in The Guardian about the Trump administration's suppression of climate warnings. Kate, welcome back to OTM.
Good to be back.
Let's start with three changes to government climate reporting. The first rollback limits the timeline certain federal agencies are able to use to make scientific predictions about climate change. The second change, at least according to a story in the New York Times this week, would primarily target the National Climate Assessment, which is a collection of reports released every few years by a variety of government agencies. But the administration apparently thinks the result is too alarmist. So what should we expect the NCA to look like now?
So it's a little hard to tell in part because, you know, the New York Times released this report earlier this week saying that this policy change was coming, that they were going to look to limit the worst case scenarios. And then in the days afterwards, heads of various federal agencies were interviewed and were a little bit confused as to what was coming out. I think a representative from the Department of Interior said the report was wrong, which may or may not be true. NOAA, the National Oceanic Assessment Agency, said that, you know, they had no plans to change their compliance with the National Climate Assessment. And so it's, I think, unclear at this point exactly what will be laid out in the future. What is clear is that the Global Change Research Act of 1990 mandates that the federal government needs to do exactly the type of forecasting that the National Climate Assessment has done. It needs to do this every 4 years. As many people who have been interviewed about this change have said, it would be illegal, in a sense, to actually move forward with this.
The third thing is a sort of content moderation infrastructure. There will be a panel of reviewers responsible for evaluating whatever federal agencies wish to publish on climate matters. This sounds to me like appointing regulators to regulate regulators.
I mean, I think calling it a regulation is very generous. So the climate review panel, as it's been floated, would be headed up by a guy named William Happer, who was tapped by Mike Pompeo and has sort of this long, long history of circulating through these various sort of climate denial think tanks and networks, and received a lot of support from the Mercer family, which has funded a lot of climate denial over the years. When this news was announced this week, a clip from 2014 of him popped up.
And the comment I made was the demonization of carbon dioxide is just like the demonization of the poor Jews under Hitler.
He is paid to go around trying to undermine actual climate science.
Exactly. He would head up this climate review panel, which would essentially evaluate the findings of federal climate scientists. William Happer does have a science background. He was a professor at Princeton for many years.
A professor of physics, it should be observed, not of climatology.
And that's sort of the case of a lot of the climate denier networks, is that somebody will have some sort of nominal scientific credential, whether or not it actually has to do with climate forecasting, climate modeling, anything remotely related to it. But they have a PhD after their name, and so they can be sort of trotted out by the Heritage Foundation or the Heartland Institute or whoever wants to use them to cast doubt on well-regarded peer-reviewed science.
That aforementioned Times story suggested that all of this began after the release of the last National Climate Assessment in November. And I guess no wonder, if you're a climate denier, like the president, the assessment was a repudiation. Trump dwells in a world of unreality, but I guess it sort of stings when your own executive branch makes a liar of you.
Yeah, and there's a couple of things happening here. One, probably Trump was himself surprised that this sort of thing existed. I don't know if anyone had briefed him on the existence of the National Climate Assessment, but there's a more kind of specific logic to why the administration might be going after it now, which is that the National Climate Assessment can be used as ammo for lawyers who are interested in challenging some of the administration's other policies to do things like expand oil and gas drilling, to ramp up fossil fuel production and exports. They can point to the National Climate Assessment and say, look, your own government's scientists have said that if you keep doing this, if you keep pouring carbon into the atmosphere in the way that you are, the results will be devastating.
3 or 4 years ago, Governor Rick Scott of Florida, now Senator Rick Scott, prevented his state agencies from talking about sea level rises. This seems like the federalization of that political strategy.
Republicans, in some sense, have a very firm grasp of just how catastrophic the impacts are and sort of what the implications for federal policy are if they do this. I mean, it's not a secret at this point that there are plenty of sort of climate scientists in the international community who are just looking sort of at the facts on the ground and reaching dramatic conclusions about what needs to happen to the global economy in order to ward off this crisis. And it doesn't take much to reach some conclusions that I think are out of sync with what the Trump administration would hope to do.
In some ways, you offer a hat tip to Republicans for at least reckoning with the consequences of global catastrophe. The Democrats, you say, not so much. There's one particular Democrat who is the front runner for the presidential nomination, Joe Biden, who has displayed, let's just say, not the greatest sense of urgency on all of this.
Joe Biden really is hoping to return to what Obama was doing when he was serving as vice president, which is to make a lot of very big sort of showy gestures toward the idea of doing something about climate change, while at the same time expanding oil and gas extraction in the greatest way we've seen of our lifetimes, and which is just very plainly out of touch with what we need to do to cap warming at sort of reasonable levels. That is not a status quo. It is either safe or wise to return to. And I think that's what Biden is really hoping for, is just to, you know, go back to sort of climate policy circa 2016.
Polls are showing that the general public is gradually beginning to internalize the scale of climate catastrophe. But the future of the planet, incredibly, it doesn't seem to be exactly a hot button issue. Political scandal and the various fronts of the culture wars are so much more dependable for generating anger and emotion and political will. At this stage, is it even really a question of more information? I mean, short of video of Manhattan underwater, is there anything the government could publish or not publish that would catalyze the public?
I don't think that there is more startling information which can be added to the pot, which will in and of itself create sort of public backlash. I think what we've seen that has actually been very effective at catalyzing sort of public opinion around this has been the social movement uprisings, which have arisen in response to things like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's report. In Europe, for instance, climate is now reliably a top issue for voters. That concern came from a number of countries having these massive school strikes. So I think the science itself is obviously important, obviously, and the science shouldn't be stifled, but I think just as important, and maybe even more so for catalyzing political energy around this, is to really make it an unavoidable crisis. And the more that that story can get out there, I think the better that is.
Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kate Aronoff is a fellow at the Type Media Center and a contributing writer at The Intercept. Her most recent piece for The Guardian is "There's a Climate Crisis, but Trump's Cabinet Continues to Backtrack on Science."
Coming up, money talks incessantly at high volume.
This is On the Media.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The man tapped to head Trump's new climate review panel, as Kate Aronoff explained, is not a climate scientist. And yet, in recent years, William Happer has made a mission of attacking climate science. Here he is at a 2016 event hosted by the right-wing Heritage Foundation, sowing confusion over why atmospheric carbon dioxide is so dangerous.
We're all doing our best to try and counter this myth that CO2 is a dangerous pollutant. It's not a pollutant at all.
The straw man argument about how poisonous CO2 is or isn't obscures its lethal role in trapping heat in the atmosphere. Thus, has Heritage worked to redirect public sentiment and policymaking away from addressing climate change and towards deregulation, which is itself part of an even bigger decades-long goal, the preservation of capital for rich people. Jane Mayer is a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. We spoke to her in May 2017.
A lot of what you think of as the modern-day machinery of right-wing ideology all goes back to the imposition of an income tax in this country, which happened sort of around 1916. there was a great uproar on the part of some of the wealthiest families in the country who didn't want to pay income taxes, and a deal was struck. Congress told these families, if you give your money away to charitable organizations, we will give you a tax break. But the gifts have to be in the public's good. And a lot of what you're looking at now, think tanks and much else in politics, actually is set up as sort of an arm of philanthropy.
Are we speaking of the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation and similar philanthropically funded organizations?
Absolutely. The Rockefeller Foundation is the granddaddy of them all. When the Rockefeller family wanted to set up its own personal family foundation, it was incredibly controversial. There was bipartisan opposition from across the board. All of these congressmen and senators said, this is an undemocratic thing to have a rich family be able to spend its money on public policy and get a tax deduction. They saw foundations as unaccountable to anybody but the super rich and playing an undemocratic role in the midst of our democratic society.
Were these big capitalists indeed figuring out a way to influence public policy?
Well, the first step towards politicized philanthropy in the view of many people was the Ford Foundation. And it wasn't for quite some time. It was really in the 1960s when it got involved in education policy, all tied up with teachers' unions and with integration and all those issues. And the right wing made a lot of noise about it, and the Ford Foundation backed off. But the right wing also learned from it and soon started pouring money into its own philanthropies that became intensely political.
The Heritage Foundation undertakes to understand and promote conservative policy and ideology. But it wasn't the first think tank. Who were the first think tanks?
The early think tanks were Brookings, which was actually founded by a Republican who wanted explicitly to have people of different points of views gather together to do scholarly work and try to solve society's problems. He wanted many points of view. The Russell Sage Foundation was also quite early. They were trying to put the best minds to work to solve society's problems.
Non-ideological, non-partisan, presumably legitimate academic scholarship.
Right. And they thought of themselves very much as neutral and apolitical, really. Many of the solutions that the earlier think tanks, including Brookings, came up with involved answers that involved government activism of some sort or another. So when the right finally weighs in with its own version, they attacked these organizations as being liberal. But the organizations were not set up to be liberal or anything else from their own standpoint.
So to the extent that the political right believed that think tanks like the Brookings Institution had aligned with progressive ideas, this gives us Heritage.
By about 1971, some of the leaders of the biggest businesses in America became alarmed. They watched the anti-Vietnam War movement taking on the companies that were involved in the defense industry, the consumer movement of Ralph Nader, and the environmental movement that was beginning to call for all kinds of regulations on pollution. And you get this kind of call to arms by Lewis Powell, who was then a lawyer from Richmond. He wasn't yet on the Supreme Court. He wrote a paper for the Chamber of Commerce, and he said, big business, if you don't get organized, we're going to lose our way of life. The enemy is not the kids who are on the streets protesting. It's not hippies or yippies. The enemy is elite public opinion. And if we want to fight back, we have to change the way the elite public opinion is formed in this country. All of the instruments that form public opinion, meaning the media, the pulpits, academia, science, the courts, and public policy. So the creation of right-wing think tanks starting in the late 1970s was an answer to Lewis Powell's call to arms. The people who set up the Heritage Foundation were literally talking about this Lewis Powell memo and saying, we've got to do something, we've got to spend money, we've got to fight back. Joseph Kors, who was heir to a brewing company in Colorado, sent a letter to his senator, Gordon Allett, and said, I've got money, how do I spend it? And an aide who was working for Allett saw this letter, and his name was Paul Weyrich, and he was one of the two founders of the Heritage Foundation, and he said, I've got an idea. We're going to set up this think tank.
And Richard Mellon Scaife, the arch-conservative Pittsburgh billionaire, came in at approximately the same time with approximately the same idea.
That's absolutely right. Coors came in with the first funding for the Heritage Foundation. Coors was a John Birch Society member, and so coming from the far right. And people said at Heritage, he gives six-packs, but Richard Mellon Scaife gives cases. He was just overwhelmingly the major funder of the early Heritage Foundation. I think he gave $23 million in its first 10 years or so. At that time, just a phenomenal amount of money.
Now, there's two ways for an institution that wants to influence policy to behave. One is to do bona fide scholarship, and that scholarship should inform recommendations for public policy. Another way is to determine what public policy you want and then kind of manufacture the scholarship to suit. Is that what Heritage did?
Right. Eric Warner, who was the chairman of the Russell Sage Foundation, said, Heritage turned the model on its head. When the Heritage Foundation was started, there's sort of an origination myth. Edwin Fulner, Jr., who was one of the co-founders and is now coming back to run it again, he was working in Congress as an aide, and he and Paul Weyrich, his friend, there was some kind of legislation that they were unhappy with, and the current think tanks that had existed at the time only weighed in after the fact. The American Enterprise Institute was a conservative think tank that already existed, but it didn't feel its place was to get involved and lobby the congressman before the legislation was voted on. And these two young aides thought, well, that's stupid. You have no effect if you're not going to get in the congressman's faces before they take the vote. And so when they founded the Heritage Foundation, it was explicitly to lobby. They weren't just a think tank. They were, as they call themselves, a do tank. It's kind of an unfortunate term, but they've used it.
You know, I have a friend who was, back in the day, a Soviet emigre. And back in Lithuania, in Soviet Lithuania, he was an econometrician. He had to fill his model with input-output data that was entirely invented by communist bureaucrats. He was told what the outcome should be, then had to come up with the raw data to produce that outcome. Is it that bad?
People like Steve Clemens, who worked in sort of conservative think tank worlds, and David Brock, who was originally on the right and is now on the left, but who was inside those think tanks. What these people who were firsthand observers inside would talk about is that the scholarship was corrupted. And they do describe that. Now, I mean, I have to say, I'm not willing to think the liberal side has all the answers and that it's always academically honest either. I'm sure that these things happen on all sides. It's just that the think tanks on the right were built for political purposes. One of the areas where this matters the most, of course, is when it comes to issues like global warming, where there's so much money on one side of the scholarship. The whole fossil fuel industry is trying to fund research that says global warming is either not real, or if it's real, it's not bad, and nobody should do anything about it because the solutions are worse than the problem. There's just endless amounts of that kind of phony science, and it follows very much in the wake of the same kind of phony science that was paid for by the tobacco industry, which for years said that cancer is not caused by smoking. You would get out of these right-wing think tanks theories like supply-side economics, which claimed that if you cut everybody's taxes, more money will come into the government somehow because the economy will thrive. Well, I mean, we've had a few experiments in it now, and it hasn't worked that way.
And yet remains an article of faith in conservative thought.
It's a zombie theory that can't be killed because it keeps being revived by these think tanks. And also it serves the purposes of the donors to the think tanks.
All right, so let's just say I'm really mad about the Civil Rights Act and the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, and I want to build myself a great influence machine. How do I do it?
Well, that's pretty much the question that faced Charles and David Koch, among others. And they were engineers who had graduated with both undergraduate and graduate degrees from MIT. And they looked at taking over American politics as a great engineering challenge. And they decided you couldn't really rely on just funding candidates, because the candidates are just going to spout sort of conventional wisdom. And so what they set out to do was change what the conventional wisdom in the country was by setting up think tanks, funding intellectuals, funding academic centers. They now fund something like 350 of them in universities and colleges across the country, funding media organizations and disputing science by coming up with counter-science studies. All of that is how you do it, and that's really how they did it.
I think it might be instructive to look at just one little point within the ecosystem to see how interconnected it all is. There was a time when Dartmouth was just one of the Ivy League colleges. Then there was a strategic investment in academic centers at Dartmouth, which became one of the hotbeds of conservative thinking, at least on the East Coast.
Dartmouth's a good example. The Dartmouth Review in particular started getting money from outside organizations, and it was an on-campus publication that became kind of an incubator for many of the more famous conservative propagandists and writers right now. Dinesh D'Souza came out of there, and Laura Ingraham, and many others. It was a directed effort by funders on the right to try to have centers in the universities that would cultivate conservatives that would then go on and become leaders.
In your book, you quote Steve Wasserman, who is editor-at-large at Yale University Press, one of the bastions, I suppose, of the liberal coastal elite, lamenting that wealthy liberal donors simply aren't as keen to make intellectual investments as the right-wingers.
Well, I thought that was a really good point. You have to give conservatives some credit here. They funded an intellectual movement, and they did it over 40 years. They played a long game, funding people writing books, people like Charles Murray, people like George Gilder, and the Democrats were much more short-term in their thinking. They maybe put money into particular political races, but they didn't really look at this whole thing as funding an infrastructure that was built to last and change the way the country thinks.
Because politics follows the money, it goes after the money, it secures the money, and it does the bidding of the money, we now have a legislature that represents the interests of this dark money. Talk about being out of touch. It's not the media, it's the actual Congress that is out of touch with the thinking of mainstream America. Is that observation correct?
I think it is in many ways. I would argue that part of the reason Trump got elected was he went in a different direction from what many of these think tanks, for instance, have been pushing. They were pushing free trade, open immigration, and they were also pushing for privatization of things like Social Security. And if you remember, I don't know if he'll stick to his promises, but he promised to strengthen Social Security rather than gutting it. He talked about infrastructure spending, which is very popular with voters and very unpopular with big right-wing donors who want to shrink big government as they see it. So, you know, Trump saw an opening there, and I would say he exploited it pretty well.
Jane, thank you so much.
Glad to be with you.
Jane Mayer is a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of Dark Money.
Coming up, the age of humans, but not necessarily in a good way.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Before we called him Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo earned the title Congressman from Koch. During his six-year career in the House, he received over $1 million in campaign contributions from the fossil fuel industry, nearly $400,000 from the Kochs. Don't know if they're related, but a few weeks ago, Pompeo refused to sign onto an Arctic Council resolution because of language about climate change. But he welcomed rising sea levels.
Steady reductions in sea ice are opening new passageways and new opportunities for trade. This could potentially slash the time it takes to travel between Asia and the West by as much as 20 days.
Meanwhile, more rigorous discussion has been taking place elsewhere, really almost anywhere else. Consider the Anthropocene Working Group, which argues that, given the evidence of humanity's profound impact on the planet, it's time to officially designate a new geological era. We're now technically in the Holocene, an estimated 11,700-year period characterized by stability. But with rapidly accelerating changes altering the nature of life on Earth, this week, the 29-member working group voted to send a formal report to the International Commission on Stratigraphy in 2021, with a proposed start date for the Anthropocene, the Age of Humans. It's still building its case, and it may take years for the Commission to approve a change to the geological timescale because, after all, geologists aren't generally focused in the present. I mean, let's face it, they live in the past, where things usually happen very slowly, though sometimes they happen really, really fast.
The classic example of the really rapid change, of course, is the meteorite impact that likely killed off the dinosaurs and that ushered in the Cenozoic era after the Mesozoic era. Probably the only example I know of a real, you know, a very bad Friday afternoon and the world changed.
Jan Zalishevich is a stratigrapher. He studies the strata, or layers of rock, which reveal the Earth's roughly 5-billion-year history. He's also chair of the Anthropocene Working Group. I spoke with him in April 2017.
Usually, things happen in a slower and more complicated fashion. The strata, therefore, reflect that change. And somewhere over that interval of change, we have to find a marker. We say, we fix the boundary here. And we fix it not because it's the most important of the changes, but because it's the best marker to give us what we call a synchronous level, the level that can be most easily traced across the world to form a time plane.
So when, in your view, does the Anthropocene start?
It's really the surface atomic bomb tests of the early 1950s. And they sprinkled the world with plutonium, cesium, americium, and so on. That level that we can follow in ice, and we can follow it in lake muds, and we can follow it on the bottom of the sea, more or less coincides with these very big Earth system changes, of the big changes to the carbon cycle, to the nitrogen cycle. The biosphere really started changing them. A lot of the physical changes as well, the production of huge amounts of concrete, also plastics, aluminium, you know, all of which are getting into strata.
You wrote a book, The Earth After Us, musing over how to read the layers of rocks 100 million years from now that we're producing. So what would aliens learn from our culture 100 million years from now, assuming we were extinct?
Let's say we've been gone for, let's say, 99 million years, so there'd be no surface trace of us. Probably they would not hit a fossilized city first, but they would find what was once a delta or a coastal plain or something. And then I think at that stage, more likely than not, they will hit upon the remains of towns, cities, big, solid, chunky things made of rock that we've built. And then the fun will really start for them.
So subway systems might be fossilizable.
Yes. Yes, you'd imagine they would be compressed, crumpled, but nonetheless, there's a whole lot of concrete and brick and wiring and things that will be completely unlike anything in the geology before or probably after.
And what about landfills? Would there be meters and meters of thick fossilized garbage?
That will be fascinating because currently a landfill site may be 70 meters thick or something like that. Mm. You might imagine it being highly squashed. But nonetheless, within that, there will be all kinds of things just packed together. Old armchairs and chicken bones and newspaper, bits of plastic, CDs, TV sets that have been thrown out. Most of these things are robust, hard, fossilizable in some manner.
Chicken?
It is something we're currently working on, you know, the Anthropocene chicken, as it were, because it is now the world's commonest bird. It is different from its wild ancestors. It's spread all around the world. And the bones tend to end up in landfill sites, whereas the bones of wild starlings and sparrows and pigeons, they will be at the surface of the ground and will be scavenged.
Mm-hmm.
Most of those will not survive. chicken bones and shoulders of lamb and beef off the bone and that kind of thing, that will also form part of the signature of this rather strange biosphere.
Now, you mentioned aluminum. Our landfills are full of soda cans.
Yes, and that's an interesting one. The metal aluminium by itself is incredibly rare in nature. We've made something like 500 million tons of it, enough to cover either Europe or North America, much of it, with a layer of standard kitchen aluminium foil. The amount of plastic is something of the order of 4 to 5 billion tons, which is enough to wrap the whole earth in a layer of plastic wrap.
Preserving it.
Preserving it, indeed, yes. The soda can, as you said. When it's buried, because it's hard, it will likely leave an impression. But aluminium underground may slowly dissolve away, like many fossil shells dissolve away, so you'll be left with the impression of the aluminium can. And you can imagine future paleontologists scratching their heads over this. Just on Earth, what was that?
You must have been excited by the big rock layer news recently. Man-made minerals identified. And yet, minerals, by definition, aren't man-made.
Yes. Again, you know, geological bureaucracy collides with the real meaning of things. I think the big news is the scale of it. So, you know, over the last few centuries, and particularly over the last few decades, we have much, much more than doubled the number of minerals. An explosion of mineral formation has taken place, which is part of the description of the Anthropocene.
And isn't it true that the last mineral created was 2.5 billion years ago when oxygen arrived?
And then it's been pretty well a plateau, around and about somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 minerals. And suddenly humans come along and there are now more than 150,000 different types of synthetic mineral-like substances. Our material scientists will take, let's say, tungsten and carbon to make tungsten carbide, which again is terribly rare in nature, but it makes the ball of most of our ballpoint pens.
100 million years in the future, what will we be able to tell about the animal extinctions that we're seeing now?
The animal extinctions and also the species invasions that we've, you know, encouraged or allowed.
That means we moved some really nice plants from Tibet to Long Island or something like that.
That's right. And so they take off like crazy and, you know, push out some of the native plants. And that is one of the big signatures. So we're really changing the course of Earth's biological history. And it's these changes that give you the big long-term signals in the strata that something happened. So the meteor 65 million years ago reset the Earth's biology. Currently, we are the meteor. There will be winners and losers. There'll be more losers than winners, but the winners will be the ones who will go on to provide future generations.
And among the winners, you think, are rats and cats.
More than likely. That happened when the dinosaurs died out. Mammals had been around a long time, but small, squeaky, furry things. When the dinosaurs disappeared, the mammals simply flowered into this variety of very large creatures, into the mammoths, the elephants, the blue whales.
Do you envision the rats evolving to fill in some of the spaces left by the mass extinction?
In brief, yes. Yes, they will evolve and there will be different forms of future rats, some big, some small, some fat, some thin, depending on the ecological niche.
Super smart ones?
They may be super smart ones as well. They're pretty smart at the moment.
Like a Planet of the Apes scenario, they're walking around and we say, "Damn you all to hell."
Yes, that's one possibility. Now, my cat might dispute that. But yes, if we do reduce the biosphere to a simpler state, then left to itself, it will then become complex again.
And we're not talking about nuclear war-type extinction. We're just talking about the kind of extinction we're doing now.
Yes, yes, we cut down forests all over the earth, and so there is no place for those creatures to live any longer. The kind of creatures that can live are the creatures that can live now pretty close to us. So the rats are, of course, a prime example of that.
Why does it matter to you so much, Jan, that Anthropocene is designated as an official period of time?
I think it matters more to me that we understand what the Anthropocene is and what it's doing. The formalization case is something that we think will help, because in science we use words to describe clear, distinct phenomena. And the Anthropocene is clearly a distinct phenomenon, different from the Holocene and previous interglacials. So by and large, we think it'll be useful.
So it doesn't matter if it's called the Plasticine or the Technocene or anything like that. You just want people to know that there's a big change going on.
That history and geological process and therefore, you know, a lot of the things that we think of as environmental change is really taking place at a bigger scale and rather faster than it was, let's say, when our distant ancestors lived, you know, hundreds and thousands of years ago.
One last question. In your book, you wrote, "We are briefly in the golden age of our power, our dominance, but we are destined to extinction also. The world will then go on as before. Once a geological age or two has passed, there'll be nothing but the odd bone or gold ring to say that we were ever here." Now, you're taking the really, really long view. Is that comforting, or are you panicking like so many others?
Oh, geologists always panic at the drop of a hat, you know. but in this case, yes, that sentence, if you like, one alternative of a number of possible future scenarios, you know, I drew in the book. Of course, we're the wild card in biology and geology. We cannot predict the future. But what we can say is that the current trajectory we're on doesn't look sustainable. So if one is to try and develop a path that is better for our own children, grandchildren, their children, grandchildren, then it's good to be as aware as possible of both present-day events and how they fit in and compare with past events in Earth history.
How long did the dinosaurs last?
Of the order of 100 million years.
100 million years.
Yeah.
Some form of man has been around how long?
Anatomically, you know, modern humans, about 180,000 years, and culturally modern humans, that is people who did art and stuff like that in caves, about 50,000 years.
Hmm.
That's a flea bite.
Right.
In terms of time.
Jan, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Jan Zalashevich is the chair of the International Anthropocene Working Group and professor of paleobiology at the University of Leicester. The idea of the Anthropocene may have taken root in the geological community, but it hasn't stayed there. Now released into the world, the concept has made its way into fields as far-flung as political science, fiction, and music, like musician Nick Cave.
The head-bowed children fold their knees, humbled in the age of the Anthropocene.
Anthropocene, an earlier formulation of the word, was coined by ProPublica reporter and Anthropocene Working Group member Andy Revkin, but it's the same idea. The word's also been applied to literature. Adam Trexler came up with the term Anthropocene fictions to chronicle the way novelists from Margaret Atwood to Ian McEwan have grappled with human-made climate change. And there's books like Art in the Anthropocene, Adventures in the Anthropocene, Politics for the Anthropocene. The new geological era fuels endless speculation about who we might be and how we might live. Benjamin Kunkel, a novelist and founder of N Plus One magazine, wrote about the Anthropocene for the London Review of Books.
The appeal that this concept of the Anthropocene has had outside of technical stratigraphy has to do with trying to understand during this age that really struggles with its attention span to think where we are in geological history and where we are in the evolution of different social forms.
So it compels the long view.
It compels the long view, which is hard to take these days.
And we've seen a lot of competing terms popping up recently. Besides Anthropocene, you've got the Plasticine, related to plastic, the Pyrocene, that there's so much burning going on, even jokily the Misanthropocene.
Yes. I've seen it jokily referred to as the Anglocene as well, because there was a period during which the United Kingdom was, of course, responsible for the bulk of carbon emissions during the time where that was really the center of the world economy.
So you focus on one term, the Capitalocene, right? What's the argument for using it?
The Capitalocene refers to a geological period or period in natural history that would be defined not just by the generic existence of humanity, which has been the case for 200,000 years, but by the capitalist mode of production, by capitalist societies, a capitalist economy.
You prefer it to Anthropocene because you see this problem as being not intrinsic to humanity.
The pace and the scope of ecological change over recent centuries is much greater than that prior to recent centuries. Certainly humanity didn't just come about, nor did the use of fire come about. What did come about? Well, the capitalist mode of production. And other people who say that the Anthropocene must have begun with the Industrial Revolution, of course, alluding to what was a capitalist industrial revolution. It wasn't just any old industrial revolution. It happened in one particular place. The Anglocene, which we talked about a moment ago, took place in England when it became capitalist. There have, of course, been English people around for a long time, too. And this is another reason to be wary of speaking of the Anthropocene. The part of humanity that is responsible for the bulk of ecological change is by no means the majority or the totality of humanity. It's people from the richest countries, which are, of course, the richest capitalist countries.
But isn't it possible that humanity really is at fault? There's a Dutch professor of psychology named Mark van Woogt who says that we're basically wired to destroy our environment because of five reasons. Humans value their personal interests over other interests. We value the present over the future. We are obsessed by status. We copy unconsciously the behaviors of others around us, and we disregard novel environmental threats.
That's certainly true, but its truth should not be exaggerated. I think that the law of entropy, the fact that we use energy-dense, very useful things, and then they are degraded into waste and trash, this meant that as soon as civilization came into being, it was clear that civilization and society were not really ultimately sustainable.
So civilization is the problem, not capitalism.
I don't think so. It's hardwired into us that we're going to die. When are we going to die and how badly we're going to die and how disgracefully we're going to die or how honorably are we going to die? That's a very important question. It's probably clear that you're going to have a devastated planet at one point. But how quickly do you need to get there? And we're getting there so quickly right now and with so little prospect of a kind of soft landing rather than a very hard landing that I don't think we can talk about these problems in a serious way without talking about capitalism.
Huge amounts of pollution are coming out of China. So why indict capitalism when it's just abundant human beings all struggling for comfort and a better way of life in the present, precisely that kind of hard wiring that that Dutch professor of psychology delineates.
But why should this hard wiring have kicked in 200, 300, 400, 500 years ago?
He would argue it didn't. It's simply that there are so many more of us now and so much more technology.
The reason that there are all these people that you refer to has a great deal to do with the Green Revolution, among other factors, that took place certainly in a capitalist context. The revolutionization of agriculture after the Second World War didn't just happen in some void. It happened in a capitalist society. We don't know what a truly egalitarian society would do ecologically because we haven't seen one.
Obviously, you favor Capitalocene over Anthropocene because there is a message tucked in there, or perhaps a call to certain kinds of action, whereas Anthropocene simply describes an epoch.
I think that there's a danger that the Anthropocene becomes too fatalistic. Recognizing now that our species is really in control of what life as a whole looks like on this planet, I think we want to have an ideal in which not just a few capitalists or not just, you know, the 1% or something is in control of our ecological destination, but people as a whole. And I don't think that socialism necessarily means that you have an ecologically sustainable regime. I just think then you have a chance. And I think we don't really look like we have much of a chance at the moment because my entire adult life, we've recognized these problems. We've got these treaties that have been signed without being ratified, ratified without being upheld in terms of carbon emissions. And so, you know, capitalism has had now the span of a young adult's life to address these problems and has failed to do so.
So even though you've seen so much that would make you cynical, you still believe that human beings can rise above their tendency to be short-sighted, status-conscious, and comfort-loving,
and all of those things that appear to have been hardwired since the dawn of man.
I'm pessimistic, but not despairing. Other universal political projects, whether the French Revolution, which is launched under the banner of the rights of man, or our own revolution, which makes this appeal to the conscience of mankind, these projects take a very long time. And by the time they're accomplished, all kinds of devastation has taken place. But it seems to me that the Anthropocene as a political project where humanity itself would be in charge and no longer simply capital accumulation, that's a very worthy political project.
Benjamin Kunkel is the founder of N Plus One magazine and author of a tragicomic play about global warming called Buzz. We spoke to him in April 2017.
The Earth creates and extinguishes life with equal equanimity. Consider the Neanderthals, a very successful line of humans for 300,000 to 400,000 years. The evidence suggests they arose in Europe in a climate much like ours during a warm phase of the Pleistocene, the Ice Age. But the world got colder and colder. We know that they were intelligent, adaptable, omnivorous, social, and strong. But maybe the cold killed them. Now, that's just a theory, one of many, but it offers a cautionary tale, because we can't really know, as individuals or as a species, how the Earth will dispose of us, only that it will. But for God's sake, why rush it? Evolution or extinction? The fork in the road. Say what you will about Neanderthals. They never stopped trying to survive.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, Asta Chaturvedi, and Zandra Ellen. And our show was edited this week by executive producer Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.